We've got a very simple agenda. We've got a presentation by the AG and a presentation by the legal. We're not fussy in which order, but according to the program, it's the AG, then it's legal. And then the committee will comment, deliberate, and issue further instructions, which we then requesting to be effective and for us to sit on Friday to look at those amendments, if any, as our last meeting before we adopt. Alternatively, if we're happy with what is presented today, then we cancel Friday and we just meet. So that's, those are the two scenarios that we have. And also the president answers questions in the house this afternoon, so we're hoping to be out of here as soon as possible. In fact, I said to Cindy, I'm sure by 11:30 we should be out of here, depending on the documents. In terms of apologies, Ms. Bengu is chairing a meeting in Parliament. Ms. Mente, Dlamini and Kuno are unavailable, and Ms. Carter was on voicemail. I don't know if you received anything. She could join us later, but she was on voicemail. I haven't had any apologies for Ms. Carter. Happiness with our program? Yes? Thank you so much. If that's the case, can we then hand over to the AG's office and talk to us, and then we'll see questions of clarity if necessary. If not, we'll move directly on to the legal team, and then we will open it up for broader deliberation. Over to AG.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, members. It's a privilege for us to be here this morning, and I'm sure that I will not take an entire 10 minutes to take you through what was essentially a very, very good agreement between the Auditor General's Office and the Accountant General's Office in National Treasury. Chair and members, you will remember where this presentation or this matter originated from. That happened in November last year when the National Treasury made a submission to this committee about their concerns regarding the unpredictability of the excess audit fee that they have to stand in for annually. That relates to all those audit fees that are in financial distress. And the committee decided to put in a proposed drafted version by the National Treasury in the bill, and then to see and test what would be the public comments on that particular drafted section during the public commentary phase. Now, while the Auditor General's Office thoroughly understood the challenges of the National Treasury in terms of the unpredictability of what this excess would be, and it's difficult for them to budget annually, we also raised with the committee, when the Auditor General submitted his response to the bill in March, we raised a number of concerns, and those concerns were primarily about the potential threat of the proposed amendment to Section 23 to the financial independence of the Auditor General. And what we presented to the committee was the potential that the Auditor General might be out of pocket as a result of non-agreements between the Treasury and the Auditor General's office on what that fee would be. Now, the committee dealt with this issue at large on three occasions, and that was when the Treasury presented, when the AG presented, and then again in your meeting of the 20th of March. And the resolution of this committee was ultimately for the Auditor General to go back, meet with National Treasury in an attempt then to come with an agreed approach to address both the Treasury concerns, but in a manner that will not pose a threat to the financial independence of the Auditor General. AG is by law compelled to do these audits. We don't have the liberty of a private firm, a private client, to opt out and to decide who our clientele should be and who not. Chair and members, we are very happy this morning then to report back to the committee that our engagement with the National Treasury has really paid off. And what you see in the revised version of the bill up for discussion today is a verbatim copy of what the proposal was that the AG and the Treasury agreed upon. Essentially what that means is what is going to be different from the previous stance, from what we have in the Public Audit Act at the moment. At the moment, the National Treasury has to fund the excess audit fee from the Treasury's vote. They have several other obligations. Obviously, the payment of audit fees is not always that much of an important priority, or it's at least a competing priority. The benefit of what we have now is that provided that a proper consultation process between the AG and the National Treasury occurs, or happens then, that, and that particular audit fee determined will then be a direct charge against the National Revenue Fund. The benefit will then be that the burden will be distributed across all beneficiaries from the National Fund or the National Revenue Fund instead of just the National Treasury carrying this burden. So, Chair, this obviously is for the Auditor General good news in the sense that we will hopefully be in a position in future to report back when we do our annual reports that we have taken care of that challenge of defraying excess audit fees from struggling municipalities, because we will be in a position then to charge those audit fees against the revenue fund. What this will also require is that there must be a money bill that is adopted by Parliament. Now, we have been presented by a concept money bill by the National Treasury already. Their undertaking is that should the committee be satisfied with how we've positioned it in the Public Audit Amendment Bill, they would now take the money bill through Parliament to providing for the charge of audit fees against the revenue fund. A final amendment that will also have to take place is the audit fees will have to be listed as a direct charge against the revenue fund in Schedule 5 of the PSMA. So, Chair, that was properly consulted. Our leadership has signed off on it, and we are quite satisfied that DRG is present today should there be any further questions on the financial implications that the committee might have. Thank you, Chair.
Right. Having said all that in legalese, what are you saying to us in layman's language? What are you going to do? You and Treasury will sit at the beginning of the year and do what? You and Treasury will sit at the end of the year and do what? You and Treasury will sit in between. If you could just put that, we understood it here, just so that we can open it up to members, because I think that was our concern. Tactically, when we go back to our caucuses, what are you saying? What must we say to them?
That's exactly that, Chair. So this amendment will then require that annually, on a determined date, the Auditor General and National Treasury will meet. And that meeting will be a consultation. The consultation will be more or less around the frequency of our audits, what the errors across the board. Yes, that's correct. So that the Treasury can understand, have a thorough understanding of where the Auditor General's office is going. And obviously, the Auditor General retains the final say of what the nature and scope of frequency of audits will be. But the National Treasury will have a voice to say, Auditor General, consider this and this and this. And the focus of that consultation would be to determine or to facilitate the determination of the excess audit fee of those struggling auditees. So that will have to happen on an annual basis. Thereafter, the Auditor General will then have a particular process that we are now going to craft, how the billing is going to work. And that billing will be done, and we are of the view that we want to take this seriously and we want to do a regulation on this process. How the consultation should look like, what the billing process should be, what the timeframes will be, and that will happen on an annual basis. And that will obviously then also be reported through our reporting mechanisms to Parliament on an annual basis. Bottom line is that the Auditor General will now be forced into regularly consulting the National Treasury, and the National Treasury from their side will have to assist us to defray these audit fees from the National Revenue Fund.
Okay. There we have it, honourable members. A very informal to South Green. Remember, the mischief was that, especially when it gets to local government, the AG was out of pocket. Because they were unable to or unwilling
about it. because they were unable to or unwilling to pay the fees, and if age is out of pocket, it means he can't do his work, and it has a roof. That was really what we were trying to address. They've now come up with a potential solution, and I think it's section 10 of this document of ours, isn't it? Yeah. Members, want to look at it, page 15 and 16. Let's open it up, Honourable Singh, and anybody else who comment just on this section.
Honourable Singh, I know everybody has a start. I don't see that they can hear. Okay, but Mr. Bell, if anybody wants to speak, it will come this way. Honourable Singh.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, colleagues, and I'm glad that National Treasury and PAX have been able to find each other somewhat. But my question was also about who will levy the charge and how. But you've spoken to the billing process, and will there be provisions made in the budgets? Will there money be appropriated, provided for this kind of payment to yourselves? That's a one. Secondly, and forgive me if we discussed this before, I mean, those auditees in financial distress, but well and good for National Treasury to pay. But did we come up with a criteria, a benchmarking? I mean, how do you, and when do you say they are in financial distress? Because you could have a municipality spending money inappropriately, the money that was budgeted for this, because they have to budget for it. When they present their budget, they will have an amount audit fee, let's say at 200,000. But if you levy a charge of 200,000 and they find their cash flow only allows them to pay 100,000, what happened to the other 100? We can't just let them get away willy-nilly, knowing now that there is this exit strategy for them, that somebody else will pay if they can't pay. So I'm just trying to recollect whether we did discuss that particular aspect.
Honourable
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman, and thanks for the presentation. I'm on the billing processes. You're saying that to implement the billing processes has to be done annually. I'm wanting to find out why has it to be done annually? Failure on your part to follow that annual process, is it not going to open up to legal implications? Because it might happen that it's not necessarily done on a yearly basis. There could be some hiccups here and there. What are the possibilities of legal implications there too? Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
And Robert Arthur?
Thank you, Chair. I've partly been covered by Honourable Singh. Is it the case that this system lets people off the hook entirely? Are you not going to pursue those who can't pay anymore? It's just going to become, well, they can't pay, so we'll claim it from the National Revenue Fund, or will there still be a process of attempting to collect from the auditees? And at what stage do you change from one to the other? What will define whether you now stop trying to recover from the auditee and submit it to this process? And then secondly, if I understand correctly, we're changing it. The bottom line here is that what's going to be paid to the Auditor General will no longer come out of an appropriation, will no longer come out of the budget of National Treasury. It's now going to be part of the Division of Revenue. So it's going, because it's a direct charge to the National Revenue Fund. So that's going to obviously mean there's less money in the budget for appropriations and more money in the National Revenue Fund. And how are we going to address this? Where's the additional amount going to come from? Because obviously it has to be funded from somewhere. So I just have this question in my mind. We're shifting money around, but we're going to be left short one side or the other, depending on which way it goes. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Adams.
I'm covered, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I think Kinsman raised the same in mind.
My fear is that if we have a blanket approach where you can't pay, AG or National Revenue Fund will pay, sooner rather than later, the national departments and everybody is going to follow the same route. I do think that we would need to have some sort of a criteria that says you're in distress if A, B, C, D, or you will have so long to rehabilitate or something, because I think the message we want to send is that it's your obligation. It's not, we're not doing you a favor by auditing. And therefore you must, I recall that the sentiment that this committee had before was to force them to ring fence. If you can't pay for your tarring of your road, it's your problem, but ring fence the 100 rand for audit fees or whatever the case might be. So I guess that's the question that we're all asking. Has that been, we welcome the fact that the AG is no longer going to be indebted with lots of money, but at the same time we shouldn't punish the South Africans, and if you guys have had that discussion. So that would be my comment, and then you can respond to everybody else's comments, and we decide if we are comfortable. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. I've listed six questions here, and I will give it my best shot and look at the DIG to fill in any gaps if there are any. The first question that we had was whether this excess will annually be budgeted for. That the answer is affirmative, yes, we confirm that with the National Treasury. Annually, when the national budget is prepared, this amount will be budgeted as part of that process. That was the confirmation that we received from the National Treasury.
I'm going to ask members to intervene as we carry on so that it's informal. Just on that point of yours, if you're saying that it's going to be budgeted for, it means you fall into the cycle almost a year earlier, because that's our fault. I mean, that's our problem that we have in Parliament also. This BRR doesn't work because it's way past. So in this one, you've taken cognizance of the fact that it will almost be a year before the... Okay, all right.
Then I think more than once, Chair, the question was raised that what are the criteria of determining whether an auditee is in financial distress? This is actually a very important consideration. It has been a challenge between us and the National Treasury, the determination of who really fit the criteria. And the problem here, frankly, is the absence of criteria. If you look at the Public Audit Act, even the way it is crafted right now, it is a legal obligation on Treasury to make a determination annually of who those auditees are that are in financial distress. In practice, that has never happened until I think last year was for the first time. So although it is a legal obligation of the National Treasury, what I can propose perhaps is that the determination of criteria and working through this, applying the criteria, can be part of our regulation and our processes that we want to craft now, just to make sure that there is some sanity in the determination issue already. National Treasury is very quick to say, but the Auditor General is in a very good position to really identify whether an auditee is in financial distress or not. So this might be a very good opportunity for us to cooperate as part of the consultation process to also include the determination of financial distress.
I would just have a concern there about a conflict of interest, because now the Auditor General is going to be making a decision as to who can pay him and who can't, and it might be in their interest to fiddle things a bit, because it makes it easier to get the money, if you know what I'm saying. So I would just have a concern that you might be criticised about that there's now a conflict of interest in your position here. Thank you, Chair.
I'm just assuming before you carry on that when you do your regulations, you're going to bring them past this committee, isn't it? For us to at least have a look at it. So I'm trying to deal with the concern raised by my classmate, because once we've agreed on the principle, I don't think we're going to get into the detail of everybody else. Why don't we say these are the minimum standards in terms of the criteria at this level? All you must do is comply. So I'm hoping that might answer your question, but if you've got a different answer, that's fine. Yeah?
If I may, Chair, the determination of the criteria for defining who's financially distressed or not is something we would have to reach agreement with the National Treasury on, so it wouldn't be solely up to us. So what we envisage is this is formalizing the regular engagements and the process for getting to those engagements at the beginning of a cycle, in fact, long before a cycle, and towards the end of the cycle, which would help us determine who falls into the pot around financial distress and who's really about financial mismanagement, as per Honourable Singh's example, and to carve those apart. to also talk about the frequency of audits, because one of the concerns that the National Treasury has been raising is about the type of audits that we conduct for smaller auditees or some of these museums, etc. It provides a mechanism without taking away from the independence of the Auditor General, but it provides a mechanism for regular engagement with the National Treasury, timely engagement about how do we audit some of the smaller entities in a way that doesn't give up the principle of driving accountability and transparency, but how do we audit them efficiently? What's the frequency of those audits? What must they look like? What must the reporting framework look like? So this is really about putting in place that formal regular engagement with Treasury that deals with some of the discomfort that has been in the system, where they say, well, we don't really know how we're going to budget because the number kind of hits us at a time that we haven't been able to preempt it. So it allows us to plan together, whom are we going to audit, how are we going to audit, what are the mechanisms of determining who's financially distressed, who's not, and then the mechanism of saying what is the amount of money that needs to be set aside through a money bill for that particular audit cycle. So Honourable Ntombela, this annual engagement would allow us to bill them on an annual basis because we would know upfront what those audits for those specified auditees are likely to cost.
In the determination of the culprit, so to speak, are you going to make sure that you consult with local government as well? Because we have seen a lot of instances where local government begins to challenge the Auditor General. So in your plans between the AG and the National Treasury, I was also going to involve local government as much as possible so that you preempt any resistance measures that could be taken at a later stage. Thank you.
Yeah, just to follow up. I'm sure we should have some idea, and maybe you can give us an answer, of the number of distressed clients you've had, say, in the last few years. You know, what numbers are we looking at? Because there have been people that you've been writing off, etc. So do you have an idea of the number of these clients that are so-called distressed? And then just following on my colleagues, very, very careful attention has to be given to the criteria. Because, you know, you'll find even with conditional grants, there are municipalities that get millions in conditional grants to do X, supposed to be ring-fenced, but they use it for salaries. They use it for something else. They use it for buying the mayor a beautiful car and that kind of thing. So I think they must not be allowed to, quote-unquote, get away with it by using money, you know, just wantonly wasting money elsewhere and saying, well, we're distressed, we can't pay you. Knowing that while there is a cushion, a soft landing for them, National Revenue Fund is going to pay. I think that's the point all of us are making here.
Thank you very much, Chair. I can't recall offhand the number of distressed auditees, but the difficulty is that number has been growing over time in a way that becomes difficult for us and Treasury to manage together because we haven't been engaging as regularly as what we should have. So this formulation puts cast in stone the requirement to engage at particular cycles so that we can determine who's genuinely distressed and who's really guilty of financial mismanagement. And also will help us talk more at critical times about the reporting frameworks, the financial reporting frameworks that tend to be a burden on some of the smaller entities, some of the smaller entities, and it's reporting frameworks we have to report against. And then there was a question about would we engage with local government. Honourable Ntombela, I assume you're talking about SALGA. The formulation here doesn't envisage us engaging with SALGA on whom we audit and what the frequency of those audits would be before we finalize it as the Office of the Auditor General. It's really an engagement as it's formulated now between us and National Treasury, because National Treasury is the standard setter and they're the ones that would have to cover the bill of the excess audit fees. However, engagements with SALGA happen on a regular basis around what the issues are that we're finding in the system of local government. the things about how they're responding to the responsibilities on the reporting frameworks, what we find when in the course of our audits, what the root causes are for those problems, and the recommendations that we seek to have them implement. So I hope that that helps to give you a sense of how we currently engage with SAGA.
All right. Koli Mbui, please feel free to participate if you have to participate. It's really the final leg now. So if you guys want to add to, contradict, educate us further, do so at the end of the day. When we're done with this chapter, we must all be comfortable. Koli?
Okay, so, what I was going to add is that with regard to the criteria that all of the things and all of my colleagues were asking, I think each and every budget review year, Treasury issued a list of financial distress municipalities. So what I'm trying to say is that they always have, there's already a criteria, which I don't know, which they use in order to come up with a financial distress municipalities. I'm looking in front of me, for example, in the 20 municipalities that were financial distress, 15 budget. And 1617, they were 22, for example, they issued that list of financial distress. So what I want to say in a nutshell, it means that they already have established criteria that they have used in order to cut out these municipalities, whether they are financial distress or not.
Do you
think?
Not sure.
All right. But we still want to see it. I'm saying you'll incorporate that.
You'll incorporate that into your regulations. We want to see it. So that if we are ever asked from our side, we are able to answer it. Okay. Are we comfortable with that, honourable members?
Yes.
Let me try and summarise them. This discussion basically is saying that the AG has no discretion. He's got to audit everything. I mean, that's the beginning. He's got to audit anything, whether these people are in distress or not. By law, he's got to audit everything. We've been saying that the AG can't be out of pocket, because then it has all sorts of ripple effects as the committee. We think the AG can't be out of pocket. Whatever we do at the end of the day, he can't be out of pocket. But we're saying that in your consultation with Treasury, we must also not compromise on effectiveness and efficiency. Why is he not out of pocket? I'm saying when they start bullying you to the extent that they can only give you 10 rand, our measuring stick is going to be, does that 10 rand afford you the ability to be effective and efficient, or are you going to cut corners? Those are going to be our measuring sticks when we look at it from our side. And there doesn't seem to be any problem. It seems to all be covered here, I think, honourable members. Or do you want to strengthen anyway? I think it's all covered here. The principle is there. For me, it'll be about scrutinising the regulation when it comes out. Is that a fair reflection? It is. So, in essence, we're saying that there's no further mandate for these people to go and do any work on Section 10 specifically or on the fees. You want to talk to that matter? Yes.
Chair, I think it will require slight redrafting. We're going to have to provide... Okay, so the new section of 16. You'll see under subsection B, the two requirements are that National Treasury must be consulted, so that's Roman numeral 1, and then Roman numeral 2 is that National Treasury is of the opinion that the auditee has financial difficulty. And what we're now saying is that the AG must come up with criteria. So that drafting then doesn't make sense that they then of the opinion. I think we're going to have to change it to say National Treasury was consulted and the auditee has financial difficulty to pay as per the criteria that's prescribed. But this issue of an opinion now is the legal difficulty that you sit with, because on the one hand we're empowering the AG now to regulate on the matter, and on the other we're saying Treasury has an opinion, and the two are irreconcilable. Because if you have criteria, then it becomes a scientific process then to determine who's having financial difficulty. So perhaps National Treasury can respond on that.
Yeah. I think yeah, you could do that. I think the point we're making is that in or after, you know the English, after consultation, between the two of you, you will consult, agree on a criteria that we will use, whether it's the criteria that Tony is talking about or tweaking it slightly, really what you guys must do. at the end of the process, if you've ticked all the boxes on the basis of that criteria, it's no longer an opinion. It's, the criteria says you're in distress and we'll be comfortable with it. That distress, I mean, that criteria we're talking about is to ensure that people don't get away with murder. I think that's what we're saying, that people just can't come up and say, I'm in distress, therefore I'm not paying audit fees, or I'm in distress and I took my audit fees and I paid for settlement. So, yeah. However you guys craft it, you look at it when you adopt it, but you must consult, come up with a criteria, somebody will tick the boxes every month or annually, and we then agree that those 20 become 22, become 30 according to the criteria, and therefore the aging must look after it. So, Fatima and everybody else, yeah, we agree. It's not an opinion anymore, it's scientifically, yeah. We look at the facts and we measure it on the basis of the facts. So if somebody challenges it, they must tell us where, which block was not ticked in the criteria. Is that accurate, members? All right? So change the opinion to something, but then we're happy. So, this is on page 15. You're saying page 15, when we go home now, other than changing National Treasury's of opinion, changing it to what we're talking about now, everything else, page 16. Is it page 20? Why have I got it on page 16? Page 20? But it's going to be page 20. Are you saying what about page 20? No, you're not. It's page 16, isn't it? Yes, page 16. Maybe it's another one. Page 16, it's got 10 on it. Have you got it? Okay. All right, Madam Rahman.
Just a question again, if I may.
Good, yeah. I noticed twice we use the words in terms of the act that authorizes the deframent of the excess. That this is in on page 16,
yep.
Towards the end of B2, the underlined words there, and then it appears again in 2 at the bottom of the page. After the 6 brackets at the bottom of the page, the words appear again. Read with the act that authorizes the excess as a direct charge against the National Revenue Fund. Does this imply that that act is not yet in existence and it's still to happen? Okay, thank you.
Jim, I want to clarify, that is the money bill that we were talking about in the joint submission. And Treasury is busy taking that through the process.
Have you
done?
Yes, thank
you. Okay. All right. So we will be looking then specifically on page 15 or whatever the new page is going to be, page 16, whatever the new page is going to be, at B, Roman 2, for a slight change in terms of tightening it up. Happy, Fatima? All right. With that change, we are comfortable with section on the fees and the management of the fees. Happy? I think we are. All right. Thank you very much. Sorry, just you were indicating there that you've got the 12 or 20, whatever they are. Do they give you the number of the stress and the rand value of Mount Ori?
No.
Could somebody do that
for us? By how much is the AG out of pocket by these distressed people, so that we just have a sense in terms of how much is it affecting other service delivery areas. I mean, we, there's nothing we can do about it, but if somebody could say to us, in 2016, because of non-payment, this was the burden in your book, in other words, if you could give us your book in 30 days, 90 days, or 12 months, 24 months period, whatever is reasonable. You don't have to bring it to us immediately. If somebody can get it and so that when we eventually sit and adopt it, we have sight of it, and just the sight of it. All right, that deals with fees and treasury. Fatima, over to you. Or unless the AG wants to have one rounding up word on that one. You guys, you happy?
Maybe
Just to your last comment, Chair, about the difference between what we normally would bill per year against this excess audit fees and what we have been receiving. I think it's important just for the committee to note that over the last few years we have been reporting that we probably get about 40%, if that, of what we would have billed to the National Treasury based on the excess fees that smaller audities and distressed municipalities are unable to pay. Over time, that has built up a pretty significant amount of money that is owed to the Office of the Auditor General, and it's something we would have been in dialogue with this committee about. I just want to bring to your attention that as at the end of March 2018, so a few weeks ago, the National Treasury made a significant payment to the office against the big amount that was owing. So we got an amount of 150 million rand that was paid to us in settlement of a large liability that was sitting on the balance sheet, and we're in the process of writing off some of the interest against some of the accounts, etc., so that we settle. So that doesn't surprise you when you see the information, because it's something that happened in the last few weeks.
Okay.
No, that's fine. Give us the liability and break it out for us. 100 rand, we've received so much, this amount has so much interest, and we're going to get it. We're fighting with Treasury, or we must write it off, whatever the case might be. You can just give us that liability, as at the end of the financial year, the last one. Okay.
Fatima, over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Chief. I'm not going to go through every single change that were made. Some were consequential, some are small little drafting amendments, and rather just focus on the main issues. So for example, things like the long title obviously needed to be changed to cover the new aspects that we've done in this draft, but I won't take members through all of that, because on Friday I understand that we are going to do the clause by clause. So right now we want to focus on the legal principles and if we're in agreement with those. Under the definitions, so page...
No, sorry, what's the time now?
Quarter to
11. Okay. You know, I'm just thinking of... I was hoping that we deal so that we don't have Friday.
Yeah.
So if you're not going to do close by close and you come close by close on Friday and we see some change, then it pushes you back, doesn't it? Is it fine? No. The question that I'm asking, must Fatima do close by close? If we all can help it, wouldn't want to be here on Friday. Now, well, we don't have a quorum anyway. Oh, okay. All right. So it means that, but we'll have a quorum on Friday. You force the quorum on Friday. Okay. All right.
And we have to do a close by close with the final version of the bill. So already these amendments.
Okay. Then it's fine. Okay. Then take us through whatever you take us through, honourable members. Then it means that on Friday we'll do the close by close bit of it.
Okay. All right. I'll try to take you through most of the changes except the very small technical ones that have no bearing on the legislation as such. In the definitions, we deleted certain definitions, we inserted others. So, for example, we've taken out the Auditing Profession Act, which is something new that the committee wouldn't have seen. And that was in order to cover the fact that the Public Accounts and Auditors Act has been repealed. So we've now inserted the correct reference there, which is the Auditing Profession Act. We then inserted a definition of executive authority. Members will recall in the last meeting, the decision was taken that the executive authority will now be the responsible person for collecting the debts that are due. We didn't want the agent to be the debt collector, so that is the reason for that insertion. And then we had quite a bit of public comment on this issue of undesirable audit outcomes, which members of the public felt was a loose term. It wasn't a technical term that was commonly understood. This was replaced with material irregularity, and there was agreement by the committee in the last meeting as to that definition. And then under section 4, there were no changes. Under section 5.
Under section 4, there were no changes.
Yeah, because remember we had a version at the last meetings. I'm only going to those new changes that we made from the last meeting.
But if you could just very briefly run and tell us what Section 4 means or what it is, what it is intending to cover, without getting into the detail, then it's fine. So it's only the 3A that we're looking
that,
at.
That was the main. That was the main one.
Okay.
Section 5. That was just some slight wording. And then on the section of international audits, the committee wasn't agreed that there's no constitutional reasons not to allow international audits. What I did do, however, was that I took a read through the Kara Akmal report that dealt with this issue, and we just changed the wording slightly, and you'll see now that they're only allowed to do an audit of an international association body, institution or organization on condition that the service does not compromise the efficiency, put an undue strain on the resources, or detract from the constitutional function of the AG. So that was a concern that came across in that report. I've added that after our last discussion. Mm-hmm. Then on the top of page 8, we inserted this new subsection dealing with the referral of material irregularities. The issue over here was that initially there appeared to be a link between the referring and material irregularity that was identified during an audit, and then actually issuing the certificate following that. And our view for the committee will report in the last meeting was to say that in certain cases the AG must be ready to proceed without actually having an investigation. So the example that Chair that you used yourself is where the car is missing. You don't need an investigation to prove that the car isn't there. The car was purchased but there's no we don't know where the car is. You should be able to act. There were other, obviously, much more complex ones where the AG was saying that the AG is not comfortable to proceed, and in those ones, the AG can certainly refer to any public body for investigation, and we use the term relevant public body. The other difference in that clause was initially said may refer any suspected or alleged. And I've taken out the word alleged because after serious consideration of the matter, we were concerned that the AG will be flooded with allegations from every Tom, Dick and Harry because they now know that the AG is going to have the power to issue certificates and then expect the AG to act. And if you said allegations there, it would mean that every time somebody alleges something, the AG would need to act on the allegation rather than the AG's own suspicion. So there may certainly still be allegations, but the test will be whether the AG then is of the view that there's prima facie evidence and suspects that there's something that deserves or that warrants a deferment. So that one word was removed. The other big change in 1B is we've now refined the power to refer to it as a power to take remedial action. And the reason was for this was in our last discussion, we considered the fact that sometimes there's financial loss in which the certificate method would work, and other times it's not a financial irregularity as such that caused the loss. So an example would be if the AG wanted to take remedial action against an entity for not adopting new HR policies or for not putting documentation security systems into place. So this widens the scope. Then we've also added, over and above the remedial action, the power to issue a certificate of debt where there's failure to comply with remedial action. So that would be only an example where there's an actual loss, but that is set out later on in part 1A.
Before you go to the honourable members, you can talk. So you're saying, A, the Auditor General does what we were saying, take it to the hawks or wherever it might be. B, he acts himself. That's what we're saying in essence. Okay, now let me go to the A then. You say the Auditor General may refer. Why are we not saying he must refer?
Because there are some cases where they may want to do an internal investigation. There are some cases...
Well, who will have to do internal
investigation? The AG themselves
okay.
do an internal investigation. They have to be allowed for them to
okay.
do
all right.
voice certified. There may be other examples where it's not necessary to refer. You can act immediately because there's sufficient information now.
Yeah, that's the B part of it. No. Yeah, that's the B part of it.
Yeah, but that is why the may is in 1A.
That's fine. That's all right.
It's still a suspected material irregularity, but there's sufficient evidence to proceed.
That's fine. And the second part of my...
The reason that we say as described means that we're going to have regulations as to how we exercise the discretion as to when to refer. That is something that the AG's office is working on.
Okay. Part B, certificate will be issued. Remember we had this big fight about but when does the accused have an opportunity to this put his case. I'm saying, is that covered in here?
That's no, that's all set out in part 1A.
Or is that
so
somewhere?
What we just checked, because it looked as if it was quite confusing to members of the public that read the original draft. So to clean it up, we've inserted a new part 1A in that chapter that then sets out that entire totally suited legal action. But we'll get to that soon.
Right. Members, please intervene if you want to as we go through it.
Yeah, Chair. I just want to know if financial loss, you spoke about financial loss and the losses. Now, what if there's exorbitant prices paid for an item? Now, the AG's office doesn't go into pricing. You go more into documentation. Three tenders, three quotes, etc., etc. That's how you do an audit. Now, when are we going to evolve to a system of you know, I mean, I paid 200 rand for this bottle of water, but it's 10 rand. Now, when are we going to reach a stage where we can do this kind of value for money audit? And then you issue a certificate of debt and say to the accounting officer, hey, you could have got this thing for 20 rand and you paid 200 rand, so there's a loss. How do we deal with that kind of, how are we going to deal with that kind of thing?
There would be nothing preventing that change in terms of the current draft. Because what would happen in that situation is either the agent would do an internal investigation, either using its own staff or service provider, or refer to the walks or any other associate body. And I assume that they will do some sort of a benchmarking exercise to get what the market-related cost of an item is. So certainly there will be scope for that. The question is more one of practicality and whether there is appetite to do it and
but
nothing in law and in this draft
would
prevent it.
But then from a practical point of view, from the AG side, you've been auditing for many, many years. How do you deal with that kind of thing? Or how are we moving towards the value for money audits?
May I respond, Chair?
Yeah.
I think... Honourable thing, it's something that we can do. What we've done up until now, you're quite right, is in the context of the regularity audit, we look at the documentation and then do a value for money audit separately around as a performance audit. Over the last couple of years, we've tried to integrate the two principles, the one that says look at the documentation and then also look at the value for money and try and have it all in, sitting in one place. So we have been migrating in that direction, and I would think that what you describe is something that's pretty imminent in terms of what how we're doing things right now anyway.
The next part deals with the Remuneration Committee, which we covered in the last meeting. And then comes the insertion at the end of page 9 of part 1A in chapter 2 of the Act. And this is the part now that deals specifically with remedial action and then the issuing of the certificate. So the first part is the power to issue remedial action. And it says the Auditor General must, within a reasonable time after the issuing of an audit report in terms of Section 20, follow up on whether the accounting officer or accounting authority has implemented the recommendations contained in the audit report relating to any material irregularity within the time frame stipulated in the audit report. So the first thing we did was to allow the AG, or to give the AG the power to make recommendations in an ordinary audit report. Some audit reports contain recommendations, others don't contain recommendations. So the AG will now have the power specifically to put in recommendations in their report. Those recommendations will come with a time frame. This was the issue that I raised in the last meeting, that I wasn't satisfied with the set time frames that the AG had inserted in the proposed three-tier system, because there are some things that can be rectified in a short space of time. There are others that require quite a bit of investigation and would take longer. So by way of example, when they go and do the audit, the outcome of an audit is an audit report, and that follows the management letter. That audit report will contain one or more recommendations, and a recommendation may be to launch an investigation as to who the source of a particular loss is, or who is the cause of a particular fruitless and wasteful expenditure, whatever the case may be. It may also say something along the lines of an entity needs to put in proper HR policies or develop systems. So it's not necessarily financial. After that stage, the accounting officer or accounting authority, if they fail to implement the recommendations contained in the report, that's where the Auditor General must take appropriate remedial action to address that failure to implement the recommendations. Now, that is an open-ended subsection, because what would be appropriate remedial action would be different in different examples. In some cases, it may be a referral to the walks. In other cases, we may want the president to intervene on something. In other ones, we may want to say to a provincial government to do something. It could be different for different scenarios. But subsection C says where the irregularity resulted in a financial loss to the state and the accounting officer or accounting authority failed to implement the recommendations contained in the audit report, the remedial action issued by the AG must include a directive to the accounting officer or accounting authority to determine the amount of the loss, if not yet determined, and to recover such loss. So that recommendation where there is a loss will always say to an AO that you need to make good on the loss. You need to collect, find the source, and you need to collect. So where there's loss, it's linked to the instruction to an AO to go and sort it out, basically. Then failure to comply with...
Just before you go to failure to comply on that section, Honourable Tucker.
So I just had a difficulty with the wording there. The remedial action issued. You can't issue remedial action. You can take remedial action. You issue a document or a certificate. Can we not just improve that wording a little something?
Yeah.
You're not
going
to that one. My word is maybe not
to you, to the AG. The obligation of making you add recommendations, is that a problem from your side? I mean, if I look at your audit report, you would say matters of emphasis and we've picked up A, B, C, D. Here, what seems to be suggested is that in the annual report, we will see two or three recommendations, specific recommendations that says, Mr. AO, go and repossess the car, or Mr. AO, go and fire the... I'm asking from a practical point, is that doable from your side?
Anything else before you answer? Any other questions? If not, if you guys could answer those two questions.
Jay, thank you. I think the first point that we should clarify is that it is not a must make recommendations. It is, we do have the right, so it's may make recommendations. That sits well with us. The only question that we did have on that one is that it seems that the may recommendations pertain only to our work on compliance auditing and our work on performance information. So the question that we had was why restrict it to those two areas and not make it available also on financial statements? That was the question that we had for clarification.
Change the word to reflect taken. like it is in the subsection before that. So we'll make that change. So in the process, the recommendations, if they are there, there must be compliance with the recommendations. If there has not been compliance with the recommendations, we get to the second stage, which is the failure to comply with that specific remedial action. Failure to comply with other remedial action may have other consequences. So we've seen that in the case of the public protector, where the public protector goes to court and says an institution or a person hasn't complied with remedial action, and nothing would prevent the AG from doing something similar, or the AG writing to Parliament to a particular portfolio committee saying that this particular department hasn't complied with a remedial action, so can you please bring them to task. But in the case where there's non-compliance with remedial action relating to financial losses, then in that scenario, the accounting officer will be issued with a certificate of debt in the form as prescribed, and in the regulations we'll give more detail as to what that certificate of debt will look like. And the AG must submit a copy of the certificate of debt to the responsible executive authority, so that would be the relevant minister in the case of national departments, to collect the amount specified in the certificate of debt from the accounting officer or accounting authority in terms of the debt recovery process as applicable to that executive authority. Because one of the big issues that we had practically is this issue of how the money is collected. Initially, in our first draft, when it was the AG collecting the money, we had some of the debt policy provisions in the legislation itself, so the AG could reach agreement with somebody about paying it off, etc., etc. The difficulty of doing this now is that because you're allowing the executive authority to collect, the executive authority would have to do it in terms of what their available resources are, the way in which their department functions. And all departments will have a debt recovery policy. The bottom line, though, is that the debt must be recovered. The executive authority must keep the AG informed of progress made in collecting the amount due. And this progress is the only obligation on the executive authority other than the fact that they must actually collect. So there's no action built in as to what to do when an executive authority doesn't do their job. Of course, you presume that the AG will come to Parliament and let Parliament know that a particular minister is not doing what they're supposed to do. There's no discretion here for the minister as to whether to collect the monies or not. The Auditor General, in determining whether to issue a certificate of debt, must consider written representations, and that's our Audi Artrum Partum rule as prescribed, and the regulations will say whether somebody must be given 30 days within which to make refs, what the form of the representations must be, what it should contain, etc., etc., and may also have due regard in considering those written representations to the progress or final report of a forensic investigation that was conducted internally by the AG in terms of Section 29, or the progress or outcome of any investigation that's been referred, or any other relevant factors. So it could be that an investigation is far enough for the AG then to already act, but we don't need to wait till the investigation is complete. It could be that the AG is willing to act even where there's no investigation, because the AG is satisfied that on paper there was certainly a loss. If the Auditor General still intends to issue the certificate after consideration of the written representations, then what we've done is we've provided a second Audi. We did have the public raise the concern that there's too much discretion given to the AG. So what we've done is that we have set up an advisory structure for this purpose, and Section 5.2b of the Act already provides that the AG may set up these external committees. And the accounting officer or accounting authority will now be afforded the opportunity to make oral representations to that committee. So the AG won't be part of that committee, but you'll have an accounting officer go to that committee and say, notwithstanding that I've made written representations, the AG still wishes to act against me. This is why I disagree with the AG. That committee will then provide written recommendations to the AG, and the AG must consider those recommendations then before taking a final decision. And the whole purpose of this is to ensure that that discretion is tempered somewhat. And also, when if the matter is ever taken on review in court, it's a means of protecting the AG, because the AG can then say, that was my initial view, it was to act, I gave them an opportunity to make representations, I was still convinced that they needed to act, I then gave them an opportunity to make oral representations, and even the advisory structure supported my view that I should take this action. Thereafter, the Auditor General must submit a copy of the Certificate of Debt to the Speaker for tabling in the National Assembly. The purpose of that was a little bit of naming and shaming, because we were asked to build that into the process, but that is why it would be tabled in the NA. Judicial review.
Before you get a judicial review,
is charged on his personal capacity as a person or as an accounting officer of a particular institution. So my understanding is that the legislation is meant as a deterrent rather than catching the person. And to make sure that this act does not happen. So actually, who is the accounting officer in this particular regard? The person himself or the person who acts on behalf of an institution?
Any other questions from members? If not, please attempt an argument. Mr. McLaughlin.
Would it be possible maybe to put in a definition of an advisory committee in the definition section?
No, that will help me.
Executive authority in relation to local government. I think we spent more than 3 weeks researching this very issue, and there seemed to be confusion about it. There certainly is confusion. But in terms of the Municipal Systems and the Structures Act, it says that it's the council. And every municipality has a council. So my understanding, when I had a meeting with National Treasury experts in the MFMA, is that what could happen is that where there's an executive mayor, because an executive mayor has more duties than a ceremonial mayor as such, then in those cases nothing would prevent council then from delegating this duty The council would take a decision. The council would receive the certificate and the instruction to collect, and they could delegate as they do many other functions in the bigger municipalities, and that would be fine. In the smaller municipalities, council would then act by using the staff that are available in the administration. So that's my understanding. On the second question of who the accounting officer is, every institution has an accounting officer, and that is defined already in the Public Finance Management Act and in the Municipal Finance Management Act. In a national department, it would be the DG. In local government, it would be the municipal manager. In companies like Eskom, it would be the board. So it just depends, but it's always defined in law as to who that person is that takes financial responsibility. So we don't foresee that there will be any confusion there. On the issue as to who the advisory structure...
Excuse me, Chair. Here is a person who has failed to execute remedial actions. Is this person liable to address that as a person outside the institution for having not complied with something that was clear to him that he had to comply with? Who takes the responsibility there? Let me make an example. Does it mean what has to be paid or who the person responsible is the council? Therefore, from the coffers of the council, the issue must be addressed. Or from the my coffers as a person, what happens there? Thank you, Chair. Maybe we should
put our understanding and then you must try and trust it. My own view.
That's why I said my own view, if we take it province and national, the person that must feel the pain is the DG, because it's his job to make sure. And that's why I was asking this question, who is the accounting authority? So province and national is very clear for me, it's the DG. But if you then go and we say the accounting authority is council, we should then say council members, because I think council is different from council members or from councillors.
It's a legal entity.
Yeah. Council is a legal entity, but you see, if we say, because there must be consequence management. That's what Scopo keeps on talking about. Consequence management for the individual. We can't go and say, well, the city of Johannesburg must now pay it back, because then you just deprive the citizens of Joburg. But you must, that's why I was saying Trevor Fowler must pay it. If it's not Trevor Fowler, then make each of the 300 councillors be docked 5 rand from their salary, whatever the case might be. That needs to be clarified. And I'm saying, I'm not sure if we, at this level, have debated it. Or maybe it's something we don't have to debate now. We can look at it for Friday and decide what we want, because it's what we want and how we will defend it. And then ask Fatima to go and, unless Fatima has got an expert view on it from a municipal finance perspective.
Chair, I think we're getting a little bit confused with the terminology. There are two centres of power. The one is the administrative centre of power and the other is the political centre of power. What the amendments are seeking to do is to be a deterrent or to punish the administrative centre of power, which is the accounting officer. So in a municipality, that would be the municipal manager. The executive authority, which is political, merely has the obligation in terms of the amendment to make sure that they collect the money from that errant official. So there would be no need to act against the council, because what would happen here in a particular municipality, we would ask, the AG would ask the municipal manager to collect the monies from the officials that caused the loss. If the municipal manager doesn't do that, that is when the AG then writes to council and says to council, I've issued the certificate of debt. Now, council, you collect it from the municipal manager, and council can do that in terms of the prevailing policy. So I think it is already covered. The decision was taken that we will act against accounting officers. They are the people that are there day to day, and they are the ones that have the financial management responsibility in terms of law.
Okay, that's fine. The point still would remain in accounting officer. I think we must define it clearly that what we mean by accounting officer in local. I think it's clear in municipal. I think in local, I think we must just be able to say that it's the city manager. Whether you can put that into the definition, because if we're fighting about it here, that have been working on this thing for a year, when we get another public hearing or SAUGA coming, they're going to have this very question. So I'm just saying somewhere here, you need to be creative and say, maybe you should just put it in accounting officer, because somewhere you were talking about accounting officer being the board and something else.
In the definitions, Chief. Yeah, so we've said the problem is that there are other pieces of legislation that also define particular accounting officers. So, for example, Parliament has its own legislation, and in terms of our legislation for Parliament, it's the Secretary to Parliament. So the way we drafted it was we want to cover all of these possibilities. So we said an accounting officer means a person defined as an accounting officer in the Public Finance Management Act, or the Municipal Finance Management Act, or any person designated as an accounting officer in terms of any other law, as the case may be. And that would cover then these additional examples.
Municipal Finance Management Act identifies the manager as
the municipal manager. Chair, then on the issue of this committee that we are referring to, the existing act already provides that the Auditor General may appoint advisory and other structures outside the administration of the Auditor General to provide specialized advice to the AG. And this is and we've done a cross-reference to that section. So you must remember this committee doesn't have the power to take a decision. It's merely there to assist the AG in the AG taking his decision. So I think it's already covered, Chair.
Happiness? All right,
what? Then under judicial review is the process for those accounting officers or accounting authorities that are dissatisfied or aggrieved by the decision of the AG. And we've said that they may approach the High Court for judicial review in terms of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, and that act provides the procedural steps that you follow when taking a matter on review. And then we've said further that in the event that an accounting officer or accounting authority has approached the High Court, the AG's decision to issue a certificate of debt, to challenge that decision, then the obligation on the executive authority to collect the amount due is suspended until such time as the court determines otherwise. Because you don't want them still collecting, and then if the court finds it was an unreasonable or irrational decision to issue the certificate, then you deal with the practical difficulty of paying back and having the executive authority also being sued. So that was just to protect against that.
All right, before you go there.
I'll come to your question. This point we are killing.
We are killing that argument that they had that it's too costly and go to the ombudsman. We took a decision that we're taking it directly to court. I'm looking at members here because remember we had that debate, and I think ultimately we decided we don't want an ombudsman, we don't want a middleman, as argued by SAUGA and others, that it's a costly exercise. So I'm saying, on Friday, if this thing stays as it is, that's what it means in practical terms, that there's no ombudsman or anything like that. We're taking it directly to court. They must pay the price, whatever it might be. Or so others spoke about the length of time or whatever. We're saying we'd have to live with all those things. That's what the implication is. Honourable Sir?
Yeah, Chair, yeah. You're right. But just on that point, the person has now left the municipality or whatever, gone somewhere else. But there's a debt that person is held responsible. Can that accounting officer still pursue that debt with an individual who is no longer with the organization if it is found that that individual was responsible for the malfeasance? Right, so that's something I want to check on. On the question, do we have to tell them here in black and white about the judicial review? Was it far for the course? Are we not opening ourselves up to say, the guys will say, hey, no, let's take this thing on judicial review now, because the Act provides for it. Or is it just par for the course? If I'm dissatisfied with something, I can go to court. So that's my second point. And the third one is, I'm just trying to grapple with the wording of this. Because an accounting officer, accounting authority, aggrieved by the Auditor General's decision to issue a certificate of debt. Now, you can place emphasis on decision in two ways. The decision has already been taken to issue the certificate. So you're aggrieved with the issuance of the certificate, not with the decision to issue a certificate. I don't know in legal terms. Are you aggrieved with the issuance of the certificate or the decision? Because certificate is already issued. In the clause before that, you said that the certificate has been sent to the National Assembly. So I was just looking at the way it's worded in legalese.
Well, should we clean it up, and I think this is correct. Clean it up and
say, well, you're entitled to normal judicial processes without us. This is good for us for debating. I'm just wondering, and I agree, that if it went out in the public, everybody will ignore everything else and go straight to 5C. It'll become the Bible. So, or should we, like everybody else says, nobody says to me that I must take it on judicial review or anything if it's my Edgar's account. I think it's just assumed that I go to my lawyers and whoever else. Is it necessary to have it in? And I know that we had this big fight with them at the time. Maybe we're now backtracking on what we did when we were at the building there. But I think it's a real question that we should grapple with between now and Friday. Everybody, I'm looking even at yourself there. Should we have this thing in as detailed as it is, or should we just put a one-liner? If you're unhappy, you have the right to do whatever, and then you've got 10 days to indicate it, so that this other part of it, which is correct, that the executive authority holds back. But, yeah, we should say you've got 7 days to indicate, failure of which two takes effect, something to that effect. But let's listen to you, Fatima. McLaughlin?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. If you receive summons, now, if you get a summons, and they issue a summons, and then they say if you don't respond within, I don't know what, 3 days or a week, then they'll go to court.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to answer Honourable Singh's first point. I'm sure you can always recover the debt in terms of the common law. This will establish the debt, and then it's a matter of recovery. It doesn't matter whether the person's working in the wherever he's working, wherever he happens to be, he can move overseas, you can still pursue the debt. I don't think that's an issue. I was just a bit concerned on the judicial review. Are we not setting ourselves up for an attack in the Constitutional Court to say you're trying to limit somebody's rights of action? Because once we say, this is all you can do, you can only go on judicial review, we're sort of shutting all the other doors. I don't know whether we really have the right to do that. And we might set ourselves up, as we've said, rather just say, you can take whatever legal action you deem necessary, just give notice and leave it at that. Thank you. Thank you.
Chair, on the first issue of acting against former officials or former accounting officers, Honourable McLaughlin is right. Nothing prevents anybody from doing so. The problem that we're facing in government is that the DGs who come to account to SCOPA use that as an excuse for not acting. They say, well, the person's left, therefore we can't do anything. And the point of this legislation now is to say, well, if the person's left and you've done nothing, then you're going to take responsibility. So find them and act against them. Certainly the PFMA allows you to write off a debt. So if you really can't find somebody and you've exhausted all the avenues, then the law does allow you to write off debts in certain circumstances, but at least they must follow those steps before they do so. On the issue of judicial review, I'm completely in agreement that it is stating the obvious, because anybody that's aggrieved by any decision can take the decision on review. The purpose of the reason that it was put in was actually because of subsection 2, which was to suspend the duty on the executive authority. But in fact, I think it is something that can practically be done by the AG. So if the AG merely communicates with the executive authority to say, we've now been taken to court, so I'm instructing you to suspend, that would also be fine. So that we can certainly take the whole of 5 capital C out. I don't think it's instrumental to the section at all. I don't think it's going to practically make a difference to how things run, and I note the concern that everyone is going to run to court because we've put it there. So we can certainly remove it in its entirety.
Chief, thank you. I think we can live with that because this will be the, with the fact that we remove judicial review, it is something that will in any event be the process. And I would foresee if a matter is taken on review, it's going to be a Part A and a Part B review. Number A or Part A will be an interdict against the executive authority preventing him from executing the certificate. So I don't see this as a problem.
So it's great. Okay.
Chair, we just got to check on numbering now as we move along.
Then amendment of section 7. This had to do with the setting up of the remuneration committee, which we did in an earlier section. Now, you'll recall that there's an independent commission that's now set up in separate legislation to deal with the salaries of all the Chapter 9 heads and judges and so on. All we've done now is to say that that independent commission, when determining the salary of the AG, must consider the recommendations made by the remuneration committee. And, of course, they can do with those recommendations what they want because they merely... they're merely recommendations and nothing more. Section 10, this has to do with the regulations that we're going to need, and it's going to be on the remedial action, on the certificate of debt, and on the criteria for the matters referred for investigation. I'll also add that we'll have to... Sorry, Chair, that's on reporting. I'm a little bit confused. I'm moving ahead of myself. On the AG's report, the AG will now have to include this additional information in their report to Parliament because we're now giving the AG new responsibilities. So we're saying in terms of your annual report, your report should also indicate which matters you referred for investigations, whether you issued any certificates of debt and any remedial action that you took, so that Parliament can then hold the relevant ministers accountable.
I'm looking at the AG. So where you now currently have emphasis on matter, you have another subheading that says whatever you want to call it. So in any case, the scope, that these are the things that... Okay, all right.
Thank you, sir. I just wanted to ask if we could change issued to taken again in F, second last on the page, please.
All right, Fatima, you can move on if you don't have anything to say on that one.
Yeah. In section 12, that's just a minor change. We took out the word prescribing and we've put setting out. The reason being that prescribing means prescribed in terms of regulations. So technically that wasn't the correct term to use there, so we've made that minor change. Section 13, just want to go to that. No, that's the one that we've dealt with, so I'm going to skip through all of that. Then on section 20, on the audit reports, this was the technical explanation that the AG's office gave us on why they wanted to change what the report looks like. So we took out the words, we changed it to say must reflect an opinion, conclusion or findings. And then we took out annual financial statements because of this reason that they may want to now only audit certain auditees every second year or every third year. So instead of talking about annual financial statements, we just said financial statements. And then section 23 is the one that Marissa explained in quite a bit of detail. And we'll make that change about regulating on the financial distress issue. Section 27, that was merely just to change public accounts an auditor's act to the Auditing Profession Act, which is actually the one that's currently in force. Section 34, there were no other changes made there from the last meeting, that just had to do with the remuneration. Section 40 were also no changes emanating from the last meeting. That's just providing that the Auditor General establishes the Audit Committee instead of the Deputy Auditor General. And then Section 41, this was the issue about the AG's own financial statements. It initially referred to GARP, but GARP no longer exists. So we've taken it out by agreement with the committee and just left it as international best practice because we didn't want to be prescriptive on which system they should use. Section 52 is dealing with all the regulations that must be made. And the reason that we're specifying it here is to show that the AG can't take these actions unless he has regulations. So we've just specified the particular regulations that must now be drafted and promulgated.
Chair, just on that one. Is there going to be a time frame for the regulations after the Act has been approved by the President?
Chair, we haven't included that in the Act itself. It's not ideal because regulations also change from time to time because we suspect that for the next 2 or 3 years the AG will have to test out the practicality of the first set of regulations and then may want to amend it afterwards. But certainly there's nothing that prevents the committee from giving them an instruction as to when it must be done.
Yeah, Chair, because we'll have an Act, but you can't implement until you've got the regulation. So from the side of the AG's office, have they given thought to that aspect? Because we want to see this implemented as soon as is possible.
Chair, I can respond to that. Yes, we've given it a lot of thought because Honourable Singh is correct. We cannot implement it without regulations. So the plan is now, as part of our implementation project internally, that there is a stream that is going to craft the regulations. So the plan is to implement regulations by the 1st of April next year. Obviously, that will then be preceded by a consultation process with the committee as well.
How do we, if the pathfinder, all of you here, including Kim, Kimmy, how do we say this to the decision you've made? I think your point is correct. Do we? I don't know. I agree we should. Somebody should be saying that the AG has got 90 days
after the Act,
or whatever the case might be, so that whether it's you or not you, or not us, somebody says, but this is the instruction. I'm looking at the question also. So I'm just saying somewhere here. And if it's the 1st of April, it's fine. You put the 1st of April and something happens to the process, then the 1st of April might come or go. It's better to say 60 days after whatever, or 90 days after whatever the case is. Because the 1st of April, we don't know what will happen between now and the 1st of April. But I just think there must be a time frame that says after it comes into law, so many months or so many days. Okay. You guys will find something to add, okay? Anything else around section 52? None? All right, thanks, President.
Okay, then top of page 20, we've done what we've called an amendment of certain expressions. So that means wherever you see particular wording, it's now amended with this new wording. I've already explained A, which is the substituting of Public Accounts and Auditors Act with the expression Auditing Profession Act, because the former is repealed. The second one that we did, which we picked up during the drafting process, was the term executive authority was used in the Act, even though it wasn't defined. And it said executive authority within the meaning of the Public Finance Management Act. And that was quite an interesting thing because the assumption there is that there is no executive authority then for any other organ of state. that it's only those that are subjected to the PFMA. So, for example, if you look at the existing Section 28 and Section 29 of the Act, which refers to 28 refers to audit reports, it says that a copy of the audit report must be provided to the executive authority if that auditee has an executive authority within the meaning of the PFMA. And that begs the question, why would you not send it to any other executive authority? So in Parliament's case, why would the AG not be sending a copy to the Speaker and the Chairperson of the NCOP? So we made that change to merely say it's executive authority rather than executive authority within the meaning of PFMA, because the executive authority has now been defined to capture all executive authorities. Then the next one is just the arrangement of sections, and that's basically just your contents clause now to cover the fact that we've got a remedial action in there. We will take out 5C, which is the judicial review. I've made a note of that. And then there were no further changes, Chair.
All right. All right.
And then, Chair, I see the operations in 1 April, now in the light of the other discussion of the time for the regulations. Do you want to stick to 1 April?
You've got 1 April in there. I'm just thinking, man. You know, it's elections year. 2019 is elections year. And it's very conceivable that all sorts of things can happen. I'm just worried about being specific 1 April. I think we should find a way that makes it open-ended and yet time-bound. In other words, after, I don't know.
Chair, we just simply replace it with a date proclaimed by the President.
All right, honourable members, that is then, and I'm assuming that AG, you've either had sight of it or you've been working closely with Fatima. You're not going to come at bombshells with it. So I'm saying this is a joint product, I'm assuming, with the changes that we've had. All right. So the process going forward, Fatima, I don't know how long will it take you, but ideally we'd want to look at it Thursday, sometime before Friday. So members will just read through it one more time on Thursday. Friday we should then take 5 minutes to adopt it. So we'll go and borrow big people. I know that Honourable Adams is not here, for instance, on Friday. So the process going for Honourable Members is that we'll get sight of the changes. Friday we would look at them, adopt it,
and then from there it goes to languages and those type of things. Then it gets approval from the languages, then on the 22nd we adopt it formally as a committee adoption. So we've got two more meetings basically. This week Friday very shortly and on the 22nd.
And then on the 22nd it is adoption and ATC. Yes, sir.
Yeah, just from the Chief Whip's forum side, I know that we'll be rising on the 30th. Now, the only two pieces of legislation we're providing for is, I don't know, what, something with science and technology and something else. That came up in the Chief Whip's forum. Now, are we hoping that we want to get this done before the 30th, debated, dusted? Because if that's the case, just you're going to work backwards from there. Otherwise, it's only going to be in August.
I think ours was as soon as possible, but it has to happen in our lifetime. This is our legacy. Now, I know that we come back in August, and we have few plenaries. Look, I think you should whisper in the Chief Whip's forum. I'll whisper to Jackson myself that, look, this thing is going to be done by the 22nd ATC. If they can slot it in that week or whatever you're talking about, that's fine for us. Otherwise, they must make it priority for when we come back in August. But it's not going to affect you guys in any way because you're looking at April. It's not going to affect us in any way, because we'll still have an opportunity before we rise. But okay, the sooner the better for me. I mean, let's lobby for now. If they beat us for before we go in June, then at least they know that it's there for August. All right.
Okay.
All right. We will draft the letter and we'll formally send it to the Chief Whip so that he can raise it in your Chief Whip's forum. Thank you very much. Does AG and his team have to be here on Friday? We're not barring. If you want to be here, it's fine. You can walk with us all the way through, but Fatima, will you be here on Friday? Okay. That's fine. So we will meet on Friday. You've got the venue yet. No. V119. If we can make it at 10 o'clock so that we are at 11 o'clock type of thing. Okay? We're not going to take weather now. 10?
We've got EPCs,
sir. Oh, we've got EPCs. Yeah, EPCs. We've got permission to set. Except some members who might be talking in EPCs. No, it's fine. We're not going to take, we've got permission to sit from 9 until 1 o'clock, but I don't see us sitting more than an hour if we get this document. So even those that are debating, I think we'll be done with it in time. All right. So, Cindy will, are we getting at 9 or 10? What time? 9. We can do it at 9, it's fine. 9 o'clock?
9:30.
9:30 in room 119. Thank you so much. Meeting adjourned.